As the year-end holidays approach, it is to be hoped that further steps might be taken to effect the release of prisoners on all sides, perhaps as a small act of good faith on the seemingly endless road to some kind of settlement in Vietnam. A holiday ceasefire or bombing pause need not be an empty gesture if some of the imprisoned hostages could, by their release, give an early sign of what peace could bring to a desperate country. Now we turn from the chaos of war to the world of law in a field that has been a subject of growing concern in this country and elsewhere. With increasing awareness of the inequities of the law and common practice affecting various groups of citizens, has come an ever more organized protest from those who now represent the over 4 million Americans, male and female, who are called homosexuals. This year, Britain adopted new laws which legalize all sexual relations between consenting male adults. By contrast, America is generally regarded a police state, although some changes are on the horizon. Tonight, a close look at those British laws and how they might apply here as we meet the Lady Gateskill, a member of the House of Lords and a strong supporter of the reform, and Anthony Gray, credited with having guided the pioneer Wolfenden Committee report of 1957 through Parliament to law this year. Mr. Gray, currently on an American lecture tour, is an expert in English law and secretary of the Homosexual Law Reform Society. Mr. Gray, let me begin with you. Your first impressions of America, having been here for the first time, I understand, just under a week or so, is it?
No, it's nearly 4 weeks.
Nearly 4 weeks now, yes. Almost a month. Mm-hmm. What do you see here in comparison to Britain with regard to reactions to the subject matter at hand? You're talking of homosexual laws and of the environment in Britain and America. What is your first reaction to the differences that you see in the public's reaction to what you have to say?
Well, I've been very surprised by various things in the United States. First of all, is the condition of the law itself, because although I had realized rather vaguely that apart from Illinois, which adopted the American Law Institute's model penal code in 1962 and has legalized all sexual relationships between consenting adults in private, whether homosexual or heterosexual, that all other states had laws which prohibited homosexual behavior, as our law used to do. I hadn't realized until I came to the United States and studied the laws of your various states that in practically every state, a great variety of heterosexual acts are also prohibited by the law, even between married people. And therefore, the laws of America are much more prohibitive than our laws ever used to be. That's the first thing that surprised me.
You expect we're more Victorian than the old Victorians?
I think that America is much more Victorian than we are in various ways, not just in regard to the sex laws, but perhaps I'd better not go into that.
We might later perhaps.
my second surprise was to find that although in some ways the expression of opinion on this subject is much more liberal and free in America, that things are said on television and in the press on the part of self-avowed homosexuals, for instance, which would not have been said in England and would not be said in England today, perhaps. Nevertheless, discussion of these matters hasn't reached the stage of open political discussion as it did in our country for 3 or 4 years before the laws were changed, when we actually had a sustained series of very serious and intelligent debates about them in both houses of Parliament.
Lady Gateskill, would you agree? You've been here in the United States many times, and what do you see as the reactions to this subject among Americans as compared to among your
compatriots? Well, I don't see, among the people I meet, I find very free conversation and very free thought about this. I really don't know about the law in this country at all, as Mr. Anthony Gray. The only thing, of course, that's different is that we have, and here I must give a plug to the House of Lords, we have been leading public opinion on this, and we have passed this law, this bill. And once you have done a thing like that, it sort of snowballs. You get public opinion getting more tolerant and accepting a lot of things rather quickly that they would never have looked at before.
Well, I was going to ask you both just how one gets this kind of movement started from a stone wall of silence to a law that is rather revolutionary. This goes way back in years, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, we were fortunate in that in the early 1950s, a number of cases involving fairly well-known people caused a certain amount of discussion, which led the government of that time to appoint a government committee to study the whole question of homosexuality.
Now, these cases were scandalised in the press at that time, were they?
They were rather sensational because they involved some fairly well-known people, and usually these cases were disposed of with scarcely any discussion. And this led to articles in newspapers, calls by the Moral Welfare Council of the Church of England for reconsideration of our laws. This, incidentally, was the beginning of a consistent degree of support from the churches for reform, which has been very strong in England.
How is it that this did not create a reaction in the opposite direction, that more efforts to suppress this kind of behaviour be carried out?
I think you're much more sentimental in this country. I think the feeling in this country about sex is that the beginning and end of it is that embrace on the wide film screen. And I think we are much more realistic about it, particularly now.
I think we've come to be, yes. I mean, there was a certain amount of reaction and an attempt to say that the law should still be enforced. But what, of course, happened was that the government, in order to get a thorough examination of the problem, appointed a committee. It may well be that some of the people who had a hand in appointing that committee hoped it would say, well, the laws were satisfactory and there should be no change. But what in fact happened was that after 3 years of very thorough investigation, a report was produced, the Wolfenden report, which said very clearly by a majority of 12-1 that the law was wrong as it affected consenting adults in private and should be changed. And this, of course, gave a great opportunity to those people who had said that the law was wrong to campaign for this change. The government said when the report appeared that they didn't feel that, however logical it was yet a ripe time to implement it because public opinion would have to be educated. But they clearly indicated that they felt that this ought to be done. And the society of which I'm secretary, the Homosexual Law Reform Society, was established. And unlike any of the American groups which campaign on this subject, it was a very broadly based organization.
So I was going to ask you, the Mattachine Society is made up largely of homosexuals themselves in this country, as are a number of other societies.
Yes, well, our society wasn't. It consisted of politicians from all parties, of prominent psychiatrists and lawyers, and people well known in the arts and the professions, and it included people of all religious beliefs and none. Very prominent on our committee were both the archbishops and several bishops of the Church of England and leaders of most of the other churches. And indeed, most of the church bodies debated the Wolfenden report in the year or two after it appeared and passed resolutions by majorities calling for its implementation. All this meant that we were able to create a public opinion in favour of reform over a period of years. And by 4 or 5 years after the report had appeared, the great balance of press discussion and of public discussion was not so much as to whether we should change this law, but as to when it should be done, whether we should do it now or wait another year or two.
Now, that report came out in 1957, just 10 years ago.
What was so fascinating about the report really was that our Archbishop of Canterbury was most explicit, most outspoken, most courageous, in a way that was absolutely staggering. Wasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, really, this was something to behold.
Well, was this backed up by public opinion polls or surveys at all?
Well, when the Wolfenden report first appeared, there were one or two polls. There was one national opinion poll which showed that about 40% of people agreed with it, and that was quite surprising immediately on the appearance of such a revolutionary report.
And yes, then I must say that this report is in great detail. I read through it. It's over 150 pages and goes into extreme detail on all phases of sexual conduct, male, female, and heterosexual.
It's a very readable report,
so,
though, isn't it?
But what it really did was it simply broke that conspiracy of silence about sex, really, in the country. I mean, this is the thing. There seems to have been a complete conspiracy about sex from teachers, from parents. Parents couldn't talk to their children about sex. Teachers couldn't explain to their pupils about sex. This has really been a breakthrough, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes,
and
certainly.
The conspiracy is now broken, and one hopes that, you know, people will become more and more aware of their own feeling, more and more understanding about how men and women are made. And
some American visiting firemen bring back reports that the pendulum has swung entirely in the opposite direction. Is there any feeling?
Oh, I think this is very exaggerated. I mean, I always used to say, estimating the numbers of British homosexuals, if you take the Kinsey figures and scale them down somewhat on the assumption that the Americans are more sexy than the British, you get a figure of so-and-so. Visiting the United States, I would say this is confirmed.
I won't accept that one at all.
If I could just conclude on this public opinion point, I think the fact that we started having discussions in Parliament about this, and notably that Lord Arran commenced his campaign to get the laws changed, brought a change in public opinion itself, so that by the end of 1965 we had two national public opinion polls which showed an identical figure of practically two-thirds of the population who believed that the laws affecting the private behaviour of consenting adults were wrong and should be eliminated from the statute books.
Well, now, Lady Gaiska, we've talked before about the differences between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, but you indicated the House of Lords led the way, that the House of Commons followed suit in this.
It did, and the reasons were, as I said before, the House of Lords doesn't have to look, the people in the House of Lords don't have to look over their shoulder at their constituents, they don't have to worry about public opinion quite in the same way.
Yet one would assume that the House of Lords was a more conservative body for the nature of its makeup.
Well, no, I don't agree with that one, actually. I don't think it is a more conservative body about some social things. Wouldn't you say, Mr. Gray? I mean, I don't think it's certainly not on social reform.
I must say it was a great surprise to me on that first occasion when we had the first vote on this subject, and we found that the House of Lords had voted in favour of change by 2-1. This was an absolutely shattering thing. It was an exact mathematical 2-1, which was a great victory, I think,
all the conservative
paved the way for the reform.
Yes, all the reactionary peers stayed at home, obviously.
Well, it's too early to tell, of course, just what effect this law will have, isn't it? Within British society, have changes occurred as yet that you've seen, either of you?
Well, I would say that it will have a largely psychological effect in helping people who are homosexual to adjust more easily to their condition and in helping other people to understand it better. We didn't have, in the last few years before the law was changed, very many actual arrests and prosecutions of people for purely private consenting adult behaviour. We didn't have the amount of police harassment, which I gather occurs in certain American cities, or the numerous allegations of entrapment which you get over here in some parts of the country. On the whole, our police took the fairly sensible view that they weren't going to ferret out what people did in private. If it was brought to their attention, they would have to prosecute it, the law being what it was, and that as long as people behaved themselves reasonably responsibly in public and didn't make an exhibition of themselves or molest people who didn't wish to be accosted by them and did not corrupt young people, they were not going to take great plain clothes measures against that either. And so I don't think that the change of law will affect the actual legal position very much, but it will have a very big psychological effect on people who have carried a great burden of guilt and unease and shame, because they have known that however right they felt their own condition and however responsible they felt their own behaviour to be, it was in fact criminal. And this led to them being regarded as second-class citizens in the community.
I want to say one thing. I don't think that this law will make more homosexuals. I think it's quite likely that there will be fewer homosexuals rather than more. The fact that you legalize private behavior between consenting adults doesn't mean that people will become homosexual, wouldn't you say?
Oh yes, I think that is quite an absurd idea. I mean, one of the things that did strike me very much was the way in which the passionate opponents of this reform discredited themselves by the illogicality of the arguments they produced. And one of the favourite arguments, of course, was that we cannot legalise this because it's so horrible and disgusting and filthy, and if we do, it would spread like wildfire and everybody would do it, which of course is perfect nonsense, everybody knows, of course, that the attractions of heterosexuality and of marriage and of family life are far too great to ever be beaten in free competition in the marketplace.
Yes, perhaps you saw the article in the New York Times magazine this past Sunday. It concluded on the note that said, wherever a culture is restrictive and rigid, it produces aberrations. If we want integration instead of burning cities, Negroes must live next door. If we want heterosexuals instead of deviants, we must grow them early. This early training, of course, in the home and the proper attitude in the home frequently to prevent the development.
Yes, I dislike the analogy. I think one should keep this thing separate from discrimination about race or colour. This is quite a different thing, but this is also a very irrational feeling And when people have irrational feelings, they should have a good look at them. That's the only thing we can do. We have to have a good look at our irrational feelings and see exactly where and why we feel as we do.
And yet, the part of the irrationality is because these people are different, as other groups are different from the norm, as people see the norm.
Yeah.
Yes, I think one must remember that always the goals of a democratic community must be to allow for differences as long as these are not positively harmful to other people. And although Lady Gateskill is far too modest to say so, she made some very outstanding speeches on this subject in the House of Lords. I always remember one thing in which she said, which was very striking, was that if men had to have babies, they'd be far less squeamish about their own bodies and would not take quite such an irrational and emotional attitude to this particular subject.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you in conclusion, Mr. Gray, as a lawyer with some experience here with American law as well as an expert on British law, should we have as difficult a time of getting a law through as you did in England, or should it take 10 years to get some changes here, according to our own basic constitutional law?
Well, I think you'll probably have a more difficult time because you've got 49 different state laws to change. The only other possibility, of course, is that the Supreme Court may one day see its way to striking down as unconstitutional all laws which interfere with the privacy of consenting adult citizens in their own bedrooms. And this is a possibility which I personally would hope is not as remote and unlikely as it may now seem.
Yes, Lady Gateskill, you have just come from successfully concluding a debate at the United Nations on statutes assuring the equality of women, or at least imploring that women be treated equally.
Yeah.
Would this be a subject for an international covenant someday?
What? The
treatment of
lesbians,
homosexuals,
you mean?
Lesbians and...
No, lesbians get away with quite a lot because they're not treated by the law at all. They're
well,
not
they are
condemned.
In America, of course.
Oh, they are
exactly
in America.
The same position.
Well, they're not in our country. We, you know, we allow them to just do what they like.
But I think, of course, they're not prosecuted in the same way that male homosexuals are. The law is the same for heterosexuals and lesbians and homosexuals who perform certain physical acts.
Yeah.
But it's almost exclusively applied against male homosexuals. This is what is so unfair about the whole thing. I think that if most married people realise that a good many of the practices commended in marriage manuals were in fact illegal and might run them in for penalties of several years in prison, they would be campaigning even more eagerly than the homosexuals for changes in your sex laws.
Well, thank you very much, Lady Gateskill and Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
We appreciate your visit here, both of you.
Thank you.
In just 2 weeks, the New York State Lottery will be 6 months old, and so far a big disappointment to its original sponsors. Recent decisions by the courts that may remove banks as legal outlets for ticket sales have also created new problems for the harried state collectors. What can be done to turn a poor bet into a good one as far as the lottery is concerned? Tonight, a visit from Fat Thomas, the former gambler who has some thoughts on this matter. Mr. Thomas is interviewed by columnist Dick Schaap.
My guest tonight is New York's newest thespian, which has nothing to do with the subject that was previously under discussion. Fat Thomas was previously a gambler. He is now an actor appearing in his first movie, The Night They Raided Minsky's. He has, as a matter of fact, been photographed before and fingerprinted, but this is the first time in motion pictures. As was mentioned, he is an expert on the New York State Lottery. In his last appearance here at Channel 13, Mr. Fat Thomas predicted the problems that the lottery has had. How do you feel now after it's been going a few months, Fats?
Well, Dick, my latest thoughts on it, now that they moved it into the supermarkets where it should have been from the start, getting to the average people in the city, and now it's going to deal with a lot of women. I believe that they should have a woman commissioner to go with the male commissioners. And I have an excellent choice in mind.
Who would
happens
that
be? To be an aunt of mine, my Aunt Eileen. She's a very, very wonderful woman, raised a wonderful family, and she's a great gambler. One day, for instance, I'm walking down Myrtle Avenue, and I see her going by in a big old limousine that takes all the guys to the racetrack. There's seven big gambling guys, and my aunt is sitting all dressed up, beautifully attired, in the middle of all these guys. So later in the afternoon, I seen Tony, the kid that drives the limo. I says, "Hey, Tony, I see you took my Aunt Eileen to the track today." He says, "Yeah, Fat, she was really magnificent." I says, "Yeah, what makes you say that?" He says, "As we got near the track, she made a beautiful statement." I says, "Yeah, what?" He says, she looked at everybody and she says, I sure hope of you men there happens to be a Shylock among you. Because around the fifth or sixth race, I'd like to meet him in section 16 to take a little advance. For the simple reason that I hate to go broke around the fifth or sixth race and have to watch the next four without betting. So I figure she's got enough smarts how to dig up money gambling. And she also deals at one of the greatest vegetable stores in the city of New York, a place run by a man by the name of Frankie Busy Corner, who also happens to be the biggest Shylock in the area. So she knows how to finance gambling, and she probably knows a lot more about the lottery and numbers than the guys that are running it, you know. So I think it'd be a big help to entice the women in the city, that they should get behind it more.
I think that's very good, and you've done a lot now to advance your aunt's career. How is your new career going?
Well, it's really great. It's an awful lot like my other career. When you're working and you're winning, it's the greatest. Everybody's ecstatic and they're up and they're flying. And the people I'm working for, Norman Lear and Bud Yorkin are the producers and Billy Freakin the director, they're treating me so good. I'm waiting for them any day to say, Fats, you got to go to the 21st Division and take a pinch, you know. You know what I mean? And it's been great. I'm working with some wonderful people, and it's just my new career. I would never think of going back to any gambling.
What are you playing in this movie?
I'm Max the Dimmer, the lighting man on the side.
Did you have any lines?
Well, I'm laughing a lot and coughing and so forth, but as of now, I have no lines.
I understand you've been running around with a theatrical crowd.
Oh, yes.
Whose party were you at the other night?
I was at a party at the Regency with Richard Bright and Elizabeth Taylor, who happen to be friends of mine.
That's very fortunate for them. Did you give him any tips?
Well, all he wants to know about is gambling and my gambling experiences, because he thinks it's outrageous that gambling is a crime in this country, and he just thinks it's the wrong thing. And he thinks that his thoughts are that I should be running a big horse room with 10 clerks and race-by-race information and the charts on the wall like the old days. But I told him the problems, and there's absolutely no chance of that, you know.
I mean, he's trying to get you out of his business?
I think he is.
He doesn't like the competition.
Well, I think there's a lot more actors going into bookmaking than bookmakers going into acting. That's number one, you know. But I don't know. He's not too worried about competition, you know. And we didn't talk too much about acting. It was mostly gambling and drinking.
Did he do a reading for you at this party?
Well, him speaking is enough, you know. I mean, he told some stories about Dylan Thomas and... he sang a couple of tunes from Camelot, and he's just unbelievable, you know.
Did you sing for him also?
Well, no, I forgot the ways to my favorite song.
What's your favorite song?
The Irish Were Egyptians, first of all, is my favorite song. I forgot the lyrics that night.
Who popularized that song?
Well, it's about Irish stonemasons and hod carriers. They apparently, the way the pyramids were built in Egypt, it had to be done by Irishmen because they're the greatest stone carriers and hod carriers in the world.
I think we've done a good job tonight. We've offended Governor Rockefeller. We've
Beautiful.
Offended the movie industry, Richard Burton, and the Irish. I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. I want to get you out of here quick so that you can get a taxi and get yourself home.
I have to be up on the set very early. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dick Shapp and Fat Thomas. Speaking of taxis, at this point, we're going to bring you a direct report. The taxi strike is scheduled to start in about an hour and 10 minutes from now, and standing by at New York State Mediation Headquarters right now at 270 Broadway, the headquarters of Vincent McDonald, the state mediation man who is sitting in on the discussions between the fleet owners and the taxi drivers union. Sitting in there is one of our reporters. We expect to report in just a moment on the potential strike, which could occur in an hour and 10 minutes. Coming cross town this evening, I talked with a cab driver who indicated that he was prepared to go back to his garage. In fact, he was told by the shop steward at his garage to be there by midnight. So let's now bring in that report, and standing by with a report on negotiations to this moment is our Newsfront reporter, Carolyn Tanton.
Go ahead.
This is Carolyn Tanton at Mediation Headquarters at 270 Broadway. I'm with Mr. Thomas.
We're standing by for that call from Carolyn at the headquarters. There's some technical difficulty temporarily. The negotiations are going on at 270 Broadway, which is New York State Mediation Headquarters. The man in charge of these negotiations for the city is City Council President Frank O'Connor. Mayor Lindsay, as you may know, is in California with the New York City Opera Company. He's also attending to what some observers say is political business while there. Acting in his behalf, but we are told without authority, is Mr. O'Connor, who is the president of the City Council. The man with the authority at this time, Timothy Costello, one of the deputy mayors, is not sitting in at this moment on the negotiations. Mr. Sweet, the other deputy mayor, apparently is not involved in the taxi talks. The major problem that would arise, we understand, in the event that the owners and the drivers reach some kind of settlement would be the authority on the part of the city to grant a rise in commissions to the drivers, which could result in an increase in the cost to the taxi driver who takes a passenger on board. Now, if the rates do go up, this would be a matter for the mayor to rule on, the mayor being out of town, and apparently none of those principals sitting in on the negotiations at this time has the authority to give the go-ahead for an increase in the rates on behalf of Mayor Lindsay. And so those at the moment are some of the outstanding issues with but 60 minutes to go. So, Carolyn, come in again with that report.
Go.
This is Carolyn Tanton at State Mediation Headquarters at 270 Broadway, where a meeting has just broken up, and standing with me is Thomas Iandoli, the chief negotiator for the Taxi Drivers Union. He will give you the details of what has happened tonight and the good news that there will be no taxi cab strike tomorrow. Here is Mr. Iandoli.
There was a request by Mayor Lindsay to Vincent McDonough, the chairman of the State Mediation Board, requesting that the taxi drivers do not go out on strike. After a discussion with the negotiating committee of the union, and we had a vote, we decided that we are going to go along with the request of Mayor Lindsay. We are going to urge our drivers to continue working until Tuesday. We have a mass meeting, a membership meeting at Sunnyside Gardens in Queens. The employers have done nothing up until this point to avoid a strike, but we have taken this action to encourage our men to go out to work and not to inconvenience the riding public. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Iandoli. I really appreciate it. And that's the good news, and I'm very glad to say, Mitchell, that I can go downstairs and get a cab, and we'll be able to get one tomorrow. This is Carolyn Tanton reporting for Newsfront.
Thank you, Carolyn. So apparently there's been a delay. There's been no settlement, but nothing apparently will happen unless the drivers themselves stage some kind of wildcat walkout between now and then. And so there will be taxis tomorrow, perhaps except during the rush hour as usual. Now let's return to our regular news front, and at the Alvin Theater on 52nd Street, a new play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, is the hit of Broadway this year. And tonight we meet the man who wrote it. He is Tom Stoppard, like our two previous guests of British origin, who at 29 is being acclaimed as the finest young playwright since Osborne or Pinter. Mr. Stoppard, whose first play opened at London's Old Vic, is interviewed by critic John Simon.
Mr. Stoppard, welcome to the show. And I want it quite clear for the benefit of our audiences that I consider your play much the most interesting thing, much the most spellbinding thing that's playing this season. And if anything said here by me sounds contrary to that statement, I don't want it to sound that way. How did you come to write Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead?
It started as a play about the same two characters, but the play, which is at the Alvin, had its origins in a one-act farce, which in fact was a sort of pastiche verse play. I'm sorry to tell you that King Lear appeared in the final minutes. Fortunately, I had the presence of mind to abandon the entire project before it got too far. And the process, however, of writing that play, which was a bit of an in-joke, alerted me to certain potentialities in the situation of these two people in that situation. It was first and foremost a response to a concrete situation concerning two specific individuals in a situation which attracted me for its comic possibilities rather than its philosophical ones at that point.
I see. Are there any of the original, the lines from the first play, from the one-act play, taken over in the final version?
I don't think so, no. There may be one or two.
And were the characters already much the same, at least in their general playfulness?
They were much the same in their general bewilderment. I don't have too good a recollection of that play. It was 3 years ago, and...
You wrote that in Berlin, I believe.
Yes, I did.
We were on a... special grant. Was there something about the atmosphere of Berlin or of the theatrical life of Germany that may have had an influence on this play?
On the play which exists now?
Well, either the old play or perhaps by extension on the new play.
There might well have been an atmosphere which prevailed in the writing of the old play, which isn't exactly to the atmosphere's credit, in my opinion, because I find it very difficult to write in Berlin. This was no fault of the generous sponsors of this picnic which we were invited on. We were given money and food and bed and board and a room and new furniture and a typewriter, paper, and we sat there looking at all the furniture and the typewriter and the bed and the board, and it was very difficult to really adjust to the situation.
And was the current play written under less favorable circumstances, less comfortable circumstances?
It was written under less comfortable circumstances vis-à-vis the bed and board, but on the other hand, I had few problems as far as I recollect. I was content to sit up all night, which is when I wrote, and get on with it, you know.
Well, the play was first, this version of the play was first done in Edinburgh, was it not?
Yes.
Was that already quite the same play as we're seeing now?
Essentially it was, yes.
I imagine it was a much more modest, small-scale production. Did that in any way hinder the ideas from coming across, or was it perhaps very congenial?
It wasn't entirely congenial. It was a church hall with a flat floor and steel and canvas chairs and a stage about the size of a couple of tables. The lighting was fairly good. They brought their own lighting with them. But it was very much a demonstration of the play, which in fact the actors involved did a very good job with it.
And who was responsible for discovering the play, as it were, and getting it transported to London and the National Theatre? Or was it just sort of general acclaim that did it?
No, I think probably the short answer to that is Ronald Bryden, the critic of The Observer, who was the first critic of importance to see it. He gave it a very good notice, which alerted the National Theatre to its existence.
Yes, I notice on the back of the published edition of your book, Mr. Bryden has become Mr. Dryden.
Has he?
So his importance has obviously increased since his discovery. You were really the only living playwright then performed by the National Theatre. Is that a very awe-inspiring thing?
It's only true of the present repertory.
Have they done...
They've done Arden and Peter Schaffer.
I guess they have at that, come to think of it, yes. But you're probably the youngest that's ever been done there.
Yes, I'm probably the youngest living. Perhaps some of the dead ones were younger than I was when they wrote their plays. I don't know.
Well, I think you must get some credit for being young and alive as well. Was the critical reception of the play and the public reception much the same in England as here, or were there significant differences?
It was much the same.
Mm.
Enthusiasm almost across the board.
Yes. Mm. No dissenting voices.
Well, One or two.
I see. It's still running, is it not?
It's about to re-enter the repertoire. They have a different system. There's three or four plays running at the same time, or rather leapfrogging each other, and it'll be there for some time in company with these other plays.
Well, now let's get to the crux of the matter. As far as I know, there are two kinds of playwrights. Those who, when they're asked what their play is about, simply refuse to cooperate in any way. And the other kind, who sometimes expatiate at interminable lengths about the play, assuming that you might perhaps be somewhere in the middle. Would you care to say what you were trying to do with this play? I won't ask you for the meaning of it. That's too crude a way of putting it. But what were you trying to accomplish with this play? What was in your mind? What was in your heart? What had to come out of you by means of this play? If that's a fair question.
It's a very fair question. It's the answer to it isn't something which one would normally analyze for oneself. It operates best at a subconscious level. I suppose that retrospectively I can look at it and try and guess what I thought I was doing. In a sense, I have answered it without meaning to be evasive when I said that it was simply enough a response to a concrete situation which developed in that marvelous, inevitable way for which one feels no responsibility and only awe and gratitude when it happens.
The tendency now is to say about plays such as yours, certainly about plays such as Pinter's and Beckett's, that these are not plays about people or about stories in the conventional sense, but that they're plays about the language or about drama or about theater. That the subject is not a character or a story, but that the texture of the thing itself is the whole play. I mean, do you subscribe to that type of evaluation?
It's certainly an element which is attractive to me in other people's work, and in point of fact in this play. I suppose that to some extent it's indivisible from its subject matter. The play was written with an infinite care as regards to the words in it, which presupposes the feeling which you have mentioned. It wasn't simply a matter of narrating a sequence of events.
But are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern people to you? Do you think of them as human beings?
Very much so, absolutely.
Yes. Mm. And are they typical human beings, or do they represent something very special?
I don't know how typical they are. I would suspect that Rosencrantz is a human being with whom quite a lot of people identify. Guildenstern, fewer people, but certainly neither of them are, I would like to think, ciphers representing anything abstract, or rather, if they are, that is not their pure function. The play, I don't think, would work, as we say, in the way that it has. I'm talking now about its success. If it were not that, the two people were human beings.
I see. Are your other writings, this is the last question we have time for, are your other writings very much in the same vein, your next play or the novel that you've just published?
There's certain similarities in texture with the next play. The next play to be produced is an early play which has very few similarities, if any at all, but the one after that is a play which does have certain things in common.
Well, we shall look forward to that very much. Thank you, Mr. Stoffart.
Thank you, John Simon. And so this has been an evening of travelers, Mr. Haydn from Phnom Penh, Cambodia, Lady Gateskill, and Mr. Gray in from Britain, our playwright, Stafford from London, and Fat Thomas, brief stopover en route to Hialeah. Now for a late look at some additional news and items plus, here again is Milt Haynes.
Channel 13 learned a few minutes ago there will be no taxi strike tonight. Repeating, there will be no taxi strike. Reporter Carolyn Tanton, talking with Thomas Iandoli, the head of the taxi union, learned the strike had been delayed, but there has been no settlement, that there will be a meeting of the taxi drivers Tuesday at Sunnyside Gardens. The negotiations, meanwhile, are continuing. United Press International has asked our assistance in selecting a 1967 All-America college football team, the UPI asking that we participate in the balloting for an All-America defensive team and an offensive team. The poll asks we take a national viewpoint in making selections. They say no one person is able to see all the college football players in the country, so many of the decisions you make will have to be based on the reports of coaches, scouts, and other football experts. That's what they say. I'm not trying to sabotage the UPI's poll, but as sports editor pro tem for Channel 13, I am going to cast the ballot, and I'd like to have your advice. I'd particularly like to vote for players from some of the more obscure schools around the country. So if you know a linebacker from Slippery Rock who'd like to be nominated for Player of the Year, let me know and I'll do it. We have to pick 22 players for offensive teams and defensive teams, plus a Player of the Year, a Back of the Year, and a Lineman of the Year. Drop me a card in care of Channel 13 at 304 West 58th, and I'll announce the teams Monday or Tuesday. I'll announce the weather forecast right now. It calls for fair and still cold tonight. The low temperature is expected to be somewhere in the 20s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, not quite as cold, with a high to be around 45 degrees. It's 29 degrees right now, Mitch.
Thank you, Milt. We know you're serious if you read Russell Baker in the Times this morning. Disregard, because that's not the kind of name that we really want. And that's News Front for tonight.